Dr. Binny Realto, were there any Burmese villages in the area?
Well, there were, but we were told to avoid them. We tried to avoid them, but we were probably felt that they would be spotting us and that information would be available to the Japs if they wished to give it. And we were followed by two men at one stage, one of the chaps in the rear section of my patrol, came forward to tell me that there were two looked like Burmese natives with rifles following us, and had been following us for the last half mile or something, through a relatively light jungle area. And I said, well, we have to get them. So just I told one of the officers at the back to just get his men to sidle off into the jungle where it was possible to do so, let them follow and then kill them, or whatever. And they did, in fact, shoot one, kill one, and the other one was brought to me slightly wounded in the foot, I think. And the problem then was what to do with him. And I decided that one, he knew where we were. He was able to tell the Japs, if we let him loose, where we were. And I had 50 men and five officers and five mules or something. That's my responsibility, and I felt I had no option but to execute him. And although I didn't enjoy this, I just felt at the time this was certainly my duty, and it was inferred from the attitude of the troops under my command that this was what had to be done. And so I did it. But it wasn't the most joyful experience I've ever had in my life. I've lived with it a little bit, but don't feel guilty, really. I just take the view that it was my duty to do it, and I wasn't a hero for doing it or anything else. I just did it because I felt it was more important to do that than risk the lives of my men.
Seems rather foolish on their part to have trailed you with rifles.
It may be, but I mean, they were, I don't think they were organized soldiers. The Burma Traitor Army were just people who took one side or the other, and they probably felt that they were able to track us and possibly didn't expect them to see them. Why they were seen, I don't know. I was up at the head of a column, and it was men behind. I think it was probably some chap had stopped, perhaps to have a wee or something like that, and they looked back and seen these guys. And then we were sensible about it and took cover, or the rear section took cover, and were able to deal with the problem.
Did you run into the Japanese themselves?
No, not at all. Not then, not at that stage. We did eventually, but that's further part of the story of this operation.
How did the men themselves behave?
They were excellent. Excellent. Absolutely first class, because we're coming to a rather more difficult situation later. Shall we say, shall I go to the on to the fact that we achieved the original mission of blowing the railway up? Our sappers were super. We just took our position up on the railway line. We never saw a train or anything of that nature, but we were very happily able in the dusk to have our engineers lay all the charges and so on. We then drew back, and they certainly made a mess of the railway lines, so far as I could see. And there was a small pumping station, water pumping station or something there, which they destroyed. And then we got out and tracked, really, aiming to get back to join the main force, which was a considerable distance. We have map references and all this sort of thing, but that was the thing to it. We'd done our job. We now had to avoid getting involved with Japs if we could, and get back to the main force. And that was I can't remember how many days it took, but it was a very, very long trek. We were doing probably about 20 miles a day through jungle territory, and we were sort of trying to avoid being followed. I remember that the engineers did some of these horrible things. What are they like now? Little things they stuck in the ground that if you put your foot on it, it went off, you know, sort of like a bullet in the ground. Not exactly a mine, but the lefties on our track Mr. Jackson to come up and attempt to repair the railway, which I'm sure they did. But then if they moved around looking for us, these things would blow their feet off. But we didn't wait to see. We were heading for home then. And the next part of the trek was just map reading, one getting very, very exhausted because food was at the minimum. We had our rations, but they weren't going to last very long. I remember my batman, a chap called Whitey. I don't know what happened to Whitey. I saw him after all a little bit. But Whitey came to me one day and said, "Sir, I think I'm ill. I've got a fever." And I didn't have anything to do with medicine then, but I could take a pulse, I suppose. And I said, "Well, Whitey, you know what happens to chaps who've got fevers. I shall have to leave you behind. And the chances are that you may get to a village, and a favorable village for the Burmese are friendly. But basically, we can't carry you. We can't, you know, we've got a major bit of trekking to do before we get anywhere near our own troops. And we can't hold everyone back. And these are more or less the indications that Wingate gave us that you'd have to look after yourself." And the interesting thing, I suppose, medically, and I discussed this later when I became a doctor after the war, and that Whitey got surprisingly better, much better than fit the first morning, and never looked back. He didn't look very well at the time, but he was very much better the following morning after we realised what the options were. And he was the first class soldier in the army, but so.
Did you ever have to punish any of your men?
Well, the punishment was, there was a muleteer, whose name I forget, because a lot of these chaps, remember, were not from my own basic unit. I just had some of my men there. The others were picked from other columns, and I hadn't known them until they all joined me. And there was a muleteer who was being a bit of a rapscallion, I gathered, from a conversation with Sergeant Major Chivers, who was with us, and a great guide mentor to me, because he'd been in the first Chinook expedition. And he said that this man needed disciplining, and that the right person to do it was me. So I got the muleteer and told him that he was interfering with the progress and the general morale of the chaps, and that I would deduct 3 days' ration from him and give it to other soldiers, and that he must accept that as a punishment. And if he didn't accept that as a punishment, or if he made further difficulties in my conduct of the operation, I would shoot him. And he accepted this and worked very well from then on. In point of fact, there's a little addendum to this story, because later, when we were moving the whole patrol, very exhausted, to Aberdeen, where Brigadier Ferguson had his base, and we were able to get out, we were ambushed, and this chap was hurt. The bullet went through the knee, I think, and we carried him all the way through the jungle to Aberdeen, when he got out, and things went well with him afterwards. I went to see him when he was in hospital, when we all got sorted out after the operation. And he was very nice, and he actually thanked me for being strict with him. He said he was very grateful that it was a bit of good discipline and that he needed it. And he very much appreciated the way we'd all helped him to survive the operation. So it was a nice, rewarding bit of leadership, I suppose.
Where did he come from?
I can't remember. I think he was from the Leicester Regiment. But, you know, there were different guys. One never had the chance to really get to know them. You were suddenly put together, you were dropped in, and then you had a job to do. And one was totally obsessed with the job and hoped that by your leadership and with the leadership of your fellow officers, who were all excellent lieutenants, there was a morale there in any case that Blaine had imbued in us. And it wasn't all that difficult. And these are just little minor nonsenses that I think were very minor, really, and we got over very quickly, and morale stayed extremely high, although the level of physical exhaustion was becoming extreme, really extreme. I mean, we were doing 20 miles, I don't know how we ever did it. We were all in place and bone by the time we finished after whatever it was, 6 weeks or something like that. And we were all, I think I lost 2.5 stone in the whole operation, and so did most of the other guys. I'll tell you about the, there's quite a finale to it, which I can tell you later. Shall I tell you first that we were heading for the main force. We thought we were doing quite well on that meeting. We weren't in contact with any Japanese at this stage, but we were very hungry and very tired, very exhausted. And all we wanted to do was to find some of our own troops and feel that we'd done our job and see what happened next. And we were sitting at one stage somewhere in some light jungle with some paddy fields around. Sergeant Major Chivers, who had managed to get out of Burma after the first expedition, and that's a terrible trail for the 13th Kings. They had a dreadful exhausting time walking up to, marching up the Chinwin and then crossing the Chinwin and getting back up to Imphal and so on. They did this, the survivors of the first operation, and it's quite horrific. But I think he felt he could do this again, and we had got to a stage where we thought we were probably lost. We'd taken, I think we'd had one supply drop somewhere. I'm sure we had a slide up somewhere. We must have had, which we managed to help us along with our ration, but we'd certainly got to a stage now where food, there was no apparent food. I think we shot a bullock, and the West Africans thought they were rather good at killing bullocks, and so on. They carved it all up, and we had a rather tasteless meal of merely raw bullock at one stage. It wasn't very much fun, but it was an effort to try and deal with our hunger. And while we were in this stage, Chivers, I think, had decided that being lost, as we seemed to be lost, we couldn't find our own troops, who we felt were in the area, but, you know, jungle is very difficult stuff to move around with, and we felt they hadn't any contact. And I think our wireless had gone US. Wireless had gone down the mountain somewhere, or down the hill or somewhere with mule, but the wireless hadn't survived. And so Shivers had taken the view that probably the best hope for us, while we were still had some marching in us, was to march back to Imphal over the Chinwin again. And I thought that was, you know, he said he'd done it before, but I mean, there were Japanese divisions up there between us and Imphal. They were trying to get through to India and nearly did at that stage. And I really thought that was a hopeless situation. But we got to the stage where we all felt the possibility of an untimely mortality was facing us through hunger, thirst, and being lost in jungle territory. And so people were thinking of making some decisions about how they might survive. And I said to Shivers, well, look, if you think you can take half the men, and if half the men want to go with you, that's great. The other half, chaps who want to go with me, stay with me, and I hope we'll find our own troops in due course. We can't be too far away from them. And we just got to this almost decision making when two Gurkhas walked out into the open paddy field about 100 yards away. And they were part and parcel of our troops who were literally 200 yards in the jungle from us. And we nearly made this terrible decision, which would have been the end of us, I'm quite certain. But the Gurkhas came and took us over. I think it was Colonel Brennan, was Cameroonians, I think. And they took us into their unit. And they had Japs around them. They were being attacked by Japs, but they got us in, mainly night attacks and so on. There were some odd Japs around. And they took us in. They'd had a pretty rough time, I think. And I don't know anything about their problems of strategy or tactics or anything, but I know that they took a supply drop then and fed us with peaches and cream and all sorts of lovely things, and we just shoveled the stuff into our mouths. We were very desperate about eating, and it was such a joy, and I think we all made ourselves pretty sick. And overnight, Brennan had wired back to headquarters, which was then General Lin Ping, of course, who'd taken over from Vietnam. And we were told, I think he told them that we were totally exhausted, which we certainly were, and that we were quite useless as fighting troops anymore at that time, and that we should get out. You see, I'd be taken out, get out somewhere. And Brennan then told me that the way out was to about, I think, 3 days' march up to Aberdeen, where Aberdeen was one of the strongholds in, that the Chindits had behind the lines, and there were airplanes and everything going in and out from Burma through these strongholds. And so I was told to take them, the chaps out, and just head for the Aberdeen, where we would finish our operation and we should be flown out. Well, this was very good news, I can assure you, and we ate everything we could and cleaned ourselves up a little bit. I don't think there were any night attacks that night, but they'd had quite a lot of Japanese around. And so we went off in the morning. We'd only gone about, and I remember we were climbing up a slope, a small hill there, it was light jungle, and we were fired on quite freely. And this shook us a bit, and we sort of tried to, I got the troops to sort of try and get up the top of the hill. We were down low, and so I thought we'd be safer up there, get up there and lie down, take cover, and see what was happening. And you could see very little. Japs were very good at hiding up trees and so on, and I think they were probably as frightened as we were. I think they were transport people or something like that. And they were just firing all over the place. And I remember John Urquhart, who was a fellow officer, he got a bullet in his compass, which was sort of lying over his kidneys, you know, a little compass which you have in your, with you. And that was, I think he had that blown off, and he also got a bullet just under his left nipple. So he was terribly lucky, John. And this was the time, the occasion when the muleteer got a bullet through the knee. Anyway, there was nothing to do. We couldn't see anyone, and the object that size to get out of it, and we got out of it and carried on towards Aberdeen. And we eventually got to Aberdeen, where we were told to just settle down. We were probably given food and water and stuff, and we were told we were to be taken out, and that the plane would be ready for us in due course. And we were told to get in one plane, a Dakota. And we got in this plane, we were sitting there for about half an hour, while the American pilot came and said, "Say, boys," he said, "I guess we've got trouble with the engine here." He said, "Are you like to wait? We get it fixed in an hour or two." But he said, "In the meantime, there's another plane over there. Would you rather go on that one?" And you've never seen people skelter so quickly from one plane to the other. The idea of having survived so far and being flown out with a plane with a doubtful engine wasn't our scene at all. So we rushed very valiantly into the other plane and were happily taken out and taken to Shillong, which is a rather lovely hill station in Assam, tea planter's place.
When those two Gurkhas appeared, had they seen you?
I think we almost stood up. We knew they were Gurkhas from their appearance and everything else, and we just stood up and waved to them, and they came over to us, and then it was all sort of, "Hey, Johnny, and where are you? What the hell are you doing here? And take us to the boss," this sort of thing. And we were all so delighted that we'd contacted somebody. We had no idea. They literally were probably 200 yards away, but this is what happens in the jungle.
You said earlier off the record, I don't think we put it on the tape, that Chivers had already been on the first Chindit expedition.
That's right. He was a very experienced boy and very fine sergeant major.
But that seemed a rather wild decision to...
Well, I think he'd done it before, you see, and I think he felt that, you know, once you start feeling you're lost in jungle, life looks very dubious. It's very difficult. I didn't feel we were all that lost at the time. And of course, one can't remember detail now, but I remember sitting there quite calmly discussing the two projects. And I was very keen that we stayed on and just carried on looking for tracks or finding some communication. I thought we'd get there. I didn't think we were so far out in our map, and we couldn't get there or wouldn't be picked up. But Chivers, I think, had got a bit of a bee in his bonnet and felt morale was low, and that a positive attitude might be more successful. He was certainly entitled to that opinion, and I don't think he appreciated, nor did we perhaps? How many Japs there were between us and Imphal? And there were divisions of them. They were beaten by Slim and so on, as you know, in the history of the war, but they were trying to get to India, and an awful lot of them. I don't think we would have gone far. The idea of crossing the Chinwin too seemed to be almost impossible in the physical state, which you will now find we were in. Because I'll tell you a little bit more about the physical structure now.
Yes, what condition were you in when you got to Shillong?
Well, we got to Shillong. Shillong is a nice hill station. And I can't remember, we were put in places to sleep, all sorts of places, and told you all right, safe, and somebody would come and see you the following morning. All this crap with the memory. But I remember the first thing we did was drink an awful lot of booze, whatever we'd get our hands on, or whatever it was given to us. And we were sort of having a riotous party somehow or other. The first night back, really, all filthy and disreputable, and no filthy clothes that we'd been wearing for about 4 or 6 weeks. And I went to bed, and in the morning I woke up and I thought, my God, this is a hangover of all hangovers. I really felt it was a classic, terrible hangover. And I tried to get around, and then eventually I had to go back to bed, and my head was thumping as if there were many, many hammers in it. And eventually I told my back from writing, I said, look, I'm ill, this is just a hangover. You better try and get a taxi or something, or whatever you do, and get me into hospital. And this fortunately managed to do, and I was then unconscious for 3 or 4 days with cerebral malaria. And really, one doesn't normally expect to survive that in the condition one was in. And I was lucky because I was in a very good, I think it was a Methodist hospital. I was told I was unconscious while there was a beautiful blonde nurse looking after me, and she went off duty, unfortunately, when I started to come to. But I was given intravenous quinine and all the whatever was thought the best treatment, and it was the best treatment and very good treatment for cerebral malaria. And of course, knowing now as a doctor, I'm terribly lucky to survive, terribly lucky. Now, when I came to, I wanted to know about my troops, you see. And I found out that I think we were 50 men or something like that. Every single person was in hospital within 24 to 48 hours of being safe. Now that was ridiculous because you could all have had the same infection with the incubation period and so on, all together, really. And what it indicated to me later in medicine was that when you know that if you give in, death is almost inevitable, then your adrenal glands and your cortisol and steroid stuff that you have in your body to try and help you to survive comes flowing in and helps you to survive. And then the minute you decide that you have survived, the cortisol subsides and the infection, which is still there, is able to rampage. And this it did. And I think every single person under my command was in hospital within 24, 48 hours. So it was a very good medical thing, which I took up later and was very interested in, because the cortisol response in defense of the body was not really put into medical literature until after I got home and started at university. It was declared by a man called Hans Seely, I think S-E-L-Y-E, who was possibly a Norwegian or Swedish researcher in medicine. And there's no doubt that was what happened, and it was a fascinating experience.
So you're all right as long as you don't relax?
I think, yes, it was rather like the Batman, wasn't it, in the earlier stage when he thought he had something seriously wrong with him, and I said, well, I'm sorry, you know, if you're not able to keep up, you'll have to be left behind. And the realization that death is possible stimulates your adrenal glands and so on to keep the pot boiling a little longer, to give you a little further chance of survival. I'm sure this is what it was all about.
How long did it take you personally to recover?
Oh, we were sent back. This is, you talked to me earlier about remembering people and seeing people. We were, remember, a unit of just numbers of people. We weren't in close contact with each other prior to being formed in the Bladet. And we were sent back to units, and I went back somewhere. I can't remember where, but Blaine was there to receive me, and some of the other officers I'd known, and I had a photograph, which unfortunately I haven't got now, and I suppose I went in probably at about 10 and a half stone. I'm pretty fit then and young. I was about 10 and a half stone, and I came out then probably at 7 or less. So in the month and with the malaria, I probably lost a good few stone. I looked like a small skeleton, but I regained my fitness remarkably quickly.
What happened to you afterwards?
Well, then once I got fit again, the next commission I had was go to somewhere, and I have no idea where this was at all, but again, in this big place. And I was sent somewhere, and my job was to train with 12 other guys, 12 troops, as I was training them, or to be trained with them, as a young officer to lead 12 man-packed flamethrower operators. And we had short training in this, and then I was sent in to play a part in the Battle of Maugham, flown in to Michener, and then flown down the night plane from Michener to Calvert, Mad Mike Calvert, who was then very near the taking of Maugham with his troops. As you know, the Chinglets weren't supposed to have involved in set-piece battles and that sort of thing, but this had happened at this stage with Calvert's men, very much reduced, having had a very hectic period of fighting with the Japs. And he must have asked for help. I don't know what happened. Again, I was on the young lieutenant at the time, and I did as I was told. And these 12 trained soldiers, Japs, were sent in with me. We'd practiced somewhere in India. And we were quickly involved in night operation with a company of King's, what were left of many of King's troops, under a chap called Fred Leland, who had been with us in Liverpool at the time. I knew him quite well. And we were to go in as a night operation into this village, which was holding up Calvert's advance to Maugham. And we were to spread fire here and there and everywhere, which we did. I don't think the troops behind us thought it was great at first. We went in under one of our own mortar barrages to keep the Japs down. They were all in bunkers in this village strewn about the jungle. And we never saw sight of them. We were just told where to go. We lined up in front of the company of King's. We were told to advance and to turn if I remember the troops saying, I hope you won't mind my usual word, turn the effing lights on, which meant that they were very happy to have the flamethrowers in front of them. And we turned the lights on. We didn't know what we were directing them at, except the village generally, with 12 chaps strung out in front of the infantry behind us. We turned the lights on. I must say it was a fantastic sight. I mean, the whole village went up in flames, and there was noise and fire and all sorts of things going on. And we went through the village like this, firing more or less indiscriminately these flamethrowers, which gave about 20-30 yard burst of flame. And the troops were, I'm not sure the troops were happy about it, because of course the chaps were in bunkers in the main,